You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right. So here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar. Heavy sense, what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. Each week, OWW Radio will bring perspective to the WWE, TNA, and everything else making news in the world of professional wrestling. My name is David, and I am joined today by Bill Behrens of Show Business Incorporated. Bill and I will talk about a wide range of topics in what should be an entertaining interview. Bill Behrens, welcome to OWW Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, you've been on the show before, but tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and about your company, Show Business Incorporated.
Well, golly, I don't know exactly where to start. If we're focusing just on the wrestling version of me, that started, well, like everybody else, more often than not, I started as a fan, in my case, in Florida, watching Eddie Graham's old stuff, and always was a fan and was a television syndicator and got to know wrestling people through that. Eventually, Jerry Jarrett was the one who reached out to me and got me involved more directly, and that was in the early 90s, and that led to me working with USWA until it ended in 1997, and Smoky Mountain at around the same time until it ended in the mid-90s, and after that I started promoting with Bert Prentice in Nashville. My primary entree was I was a TV syndicator. I was putting TV shows on TV stations, so my first presence was sort of that guy, and my first contracts with both WWE and WCW had to do with me distributing a wrestling show, whether it was USWA or Music City Wrestling or NWA Worldwide or eventually NWA Wildside, and these entities were subletting the show's commercial time and adding it to their distribution, and I was getting paid from that. And then beyond that, I started promoting with Bird in 97, have continued to be involved in promoting since then, but have also continued consecutive weekly television since then. Now, I don't know, somewhere over 1,000 consecutive episodes, give or take, many of them in a little building in Cornelia, Georgia, where now we do a show called Anarchy. So that was my first entree. Then I got involved developing talent. I learned I really wasn't that good a promoter. Bert was an excellent promoter, knew how to put butts into seats. I am not that good for a variety of reasons. But what I did figure out was that I was pretty good at developing wrestlers and helping them get jobs. And we started that in Music City. We had created a group called the Bad Street Boys, which was Shannon Moore, Shane Helms, Christian York, and Joey Matthews. Mm-hmm. And all of them either got hired or got development deals or both out of that. In fact, they were discovered in quotations, or at least two of them were and signed, and then the other two were signed later, because we had done a video of them as if they were a boy band, although that's really not what they were in our use, but that was seen by Jimmy Hart in late night TV in Atlanta, and that led to Three Count,
right?
Eventually. So that was our beginning. It led to first WCW hiring me, and at the time my Wildside promotion, to develop WCW talent, but this was in the last year of its existence, so it was only a short-lived opportunity. But they were sending most of their young talent to us to work out matches in our little ring before they took them out on the road. So the Jindraks and O'Hares of the world, Bob Sapp, various people they were trying to develop at the time were sent in to get additional work. Eventually, with my Wildside began developing people, perhaps the most famous of which is AJ Styles, my primary client. And eventually in 2005, I was brought on board by WWE again, this time to set up the Deep South development area where I enjoyed three dismal months before resigning. Prior to that, I had been involved in the launch of TNA, and then I went back to TNA after that. But throughout all of that, I was helping the talent I was developing getting booked, and over time was helping book other people because they found out I was doing it. I ended up setting up what I call SBI Booking. Show Business Inc. is my company, a company I set up for TV distribution a long time ago. And to date, I continue to do that. In fact, my last job with TNA was as its in-house booker. TNA, in its earlier life, in 2005, had very few people under exclusive contracts, or at least contracts that paid them on a weekly basis. They were more or less pay-as-you-go kind of deals for almost everybody.
Right.
And Jeff Jarrett, actually, and a CEO at the time, came up with the idea of why don't we sign these guys to contracts, figure out a way to pay them weekly, and subsidize the money we're paying out by getting independent promoters to book the guys, and we collect the money, hang on to a small percentage of it, and use it to fund the contracts. So we developed a deal where people got what looked to be guaranteed deals, but basically what we were calling the money we were paying out was a draw against future revenues. Some of those revenues were TV and pay-per-view monies from TNA at a certain rate. Others were whatever we could make on the indies. And over about a two-year period prior to house shows being started, we brought in a couple of $1 million doing that, and it led to the earliest guaranteed contracts by TNA, or at least contracts where people could expect a weekly check. Eventually, that became perceived as conflicting with the growth of house shows, the theory being somebody like me might prioritize booking Kurt Angle on an indie rather than booking him on a house show, since I was involved in also booking the early house shows with Terry Taylor. Well, mm-hmm. That wasn't true. Perception becomes reality at times, and it led to them deciding to bring the third-party booking, as we called it, in-house. Bob Ryder was assigned the spot. But really, the priority was we really don't want the guys to go out as much. We want them to be as exclusive as possible to our house shows. Problem with that, obviously, was they were only booking 14 to 16 people on the house shows and had 30 to 40 under contract. So it sort of stopped the ability of a number of people from making additional money, and it became a problem in terms of how the contracts were written, because now the draws were exceeding the revenues that were coming in, and an awful lot had to be redone after I left. But actually, there were draw contracts that were in existence literally until last year, when the first one finally, when the last one finally went away. So that's a short, Mike. You know, now I'm not with TNA, but I represent a diversity of talent. AJ Styles is my primary client. Christopher Daniels is another primary client. Jay Lethal's a client. Quite a few people where I not only book them, but I also manage their careers and negotiate their contracts. And then there's others like Scott Steiner, Rick Steiner, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, list goes on, who I'm just a booker. I book them out, I take a percentage, and I babysit the booking for them. And a lot of the guys have found that that's easier for them. And good promoters rarely have a problem with it, because the babysitting actually helps them have a smoother time with the talent they book. The only time I have difficulty are promoters that try to play loosey-goosey with the money that they may or may not have.
Right.
So, you know, if they book through me, it's more difficult, because I require things like deposits and flights that actually get to the city where the show is, and, you know, little crazy things like that.
Right. I can't believe it. It's terrible of you, Bill, to actually require payment.
Yeah, well, it's a wacky concept. There's a lot of promoters that believe it's, I guess, in their mind that this is like the old days where everything was paid off the gate. You know, back in the day, you know, if you were in Memphis, 23% was paid off the gate. If you're in the Crockett area, 30-some percent was paid off the gate, and that's how it was done, and you were paid based on your position on the card. However, that was then, this is now, and now most promoters can't really promote, unfortunately. And the end result of that is they've got to know what money they're planning to either spend, or perhaps the word lose would be better, going in, and they have to be prepared to pay that regardless. We hear horror stories all the time of people running to the hospital with heart attacks or escaping with the box office and leaving the boys behind. Most recently, a gentleman in Canada did that and left a whole bunch of people without money as his wife, in theory, brought him to the hospital with a heart attack. It's amazing how many heart attacks promoters have. Also, I've learned that buildings are easily double-booked by the building. It's something they do all the time. They don't keep track of their own schedule. And there's often deaths in the family that result in shows being canceled. It's amazing how many people have died in the name of wrestling.
I love your story because you say you did start off as you know, a fan of the business, as we all did. And isn't it nice that you've been able to contribute in so many different ways, to kind of have your fingerprints on so many different aspects of this business? You know, from you said you weren't a great promoter, you liked doing the booking and you worked in television. Did you ever want to be an actual wrestler?
I was a bad wrestler, but more of a I was a heel in Nashville for a period of time, and Burt Prentice actually drew houses, putting my useless butt into the ring. Something I've never encouraged myself to do. The number of matches I've had can be counted on my hands, the most famous of which was against the Colorado kid Mike Rapata for the North American title in Nashville, where we drew a house and entertained the crowd for a measly 5 minutes with me getting pinned in the end. And then there were several dismal matches, one with Mike Porter that was just hideously bad, causing Sabu to nearly choke on himself laughing. And I had a couple in Wildside, but usually over a lot of objections on my part. But I'm creeping towards 60 right now. So quite honestly, when I got involved in the wrestling business, my first bump, which was taken for Tommy Dreamer in Memphis at a TV taping, I was 40 years old. Mm-hmm. So the odds of me really being able to go out there and wrestle when you start at 40, what I can tell you is that anyone that wants to get involved in wrestling and bump, I don't suggest they start at 40, because when you're 58, as I am now, you have a tendency to need a chiropractor because of it. It's hard enough for the young people. Us old folks should avoid just saying no. I mean, it's probably just a good idea to say no.
I think that's fair. I just turned 40 recently, and if I fell out of this chair right now, I'd have to get some medical treatment. When I was younger, I've always loved this business. I've been fortunate to get into some of the media aspects of it. I think that's what's great about professional wrestling. If you love it, there are ways for you to contribute other than being a wrestler. And what I find interesting about your involvement with the talent, you say how you help them develop. You help them develop. You help them get jobs. I know today social media is such a large part of what they need to do on their own. How do you use social media to help them get promoted and help them get jobs?
Social media is a piece of the puzzle. The primary mechanism to developing talent is to teach the essentials that allow someone to become a star. And in this business, the only way you're ever really going to make money is to get on real television, and that would mean get to WWE and be able to perform on television, get to TNA and be able to perform on television, get to Ring of Honor and be able to perform on television. Those are the companies in this country that are right now able to pay enough that at least a few people, if not many in each company, can call it a career. It's extremely hard, if not damn close to impossible, to make a living in wrestling from the start as an indie guy. Even the most successful guys going out, the ones that are booked every weekend, are probably guys that are getting between $150 to $300 as they come up. Mm-hmm. And if you'd run the math on that, even if somebody's booked twice a weekend, that's still just a little over $30,000. Perhaps their expenses are paid. Maybe they'll make additional gimmick money. But there are only so many Colt Cabanas that can make that work. Or Christopher Daniels in another time. For an example, AJ Styles had been signed to WCW, had a handful of matches with Air Paris as his partner, and then WCW went out of business, and he was back out on the indies. And at that time, which was 2001, he was literally a $75 to $150 guy, primarily working in the Southeast. And you think back and you go, well, wait, this is the guy that was just signed to WCW. Why wasn't he making money? Well, the reality was he hadn't been anywhere before going to WCW. They had found him at my little building because we did a TV show and developed people that were ready to go on TV. So I booked him against Chris Daniels at a show in Florida that was promoted by Howard Brody and Ron Neamey. And when AJ won the match with some interference by Jeff G. Bailey, the manager, you could hear the cameraman audibly go on the tape that's available, "Oh, my God, what an upset." AJ and Chris Daniels. Well, at the time, Chris Daniels was a big star. You know, mm-hmm. he was making hundreds on the indies and had had a cup of coffee, a couple of matches in here and a couple of matches there, and people knew who he was. The Fallen Angel was a big deal on the indies. AJ Styles was nobody. But he worked Christopher Daniels in that time, well before the real impact of social media, but there was enough social media that people heard about it. It became buzzworthy. Next thing you know, AJ was doing a tournament out on the West Coast, and then he did the Super 8 for Jimmy Kettner. And after those three things are done, in with two of them, he worked Chris Daniels, going over the first time, under the second time. And by the time those three indie spots were done, all of a sudden he had gone from being a $75 to $150 guy to a $300 guy. Went on a trip of Australia that I went on with him for the WWL for McManus's thing, and did a pay-per-view over there, became a champion over there, came back, TNA started, and he was the first guy signed. Got discovered in a match with David Young by Jerry Jarrett at in Nashville on a show promoted by Burt, and all of a sudden he's getting paid and has a career in professional wrestling again. But he was only an indie star getting paid for basically part of 2001 and early 2002, and before he was able to get signed. And it's rare that, and who knows what would have happened if he hadn't had those, had he gone to WCW development like he was offered and made $500 a week, would he have been brought up, would he have been a star in that time, or would he have been released and starting over? Would TNA have been interested at that time if he hadn't chosen TNA? You know, so there's a lot of speculative, but the developing aspect is, as I tell the guys, I'm not the guy that's going to be paying you, but if I do my job right and I teach you the things you need to know, and it's not how to lock up, there's other people that do that. I'm not that guy. I can tell them when they're doing something right or wrong, but I'm not the guy that's going to teach them the intricacies of how to put how to layer a match based on the actual moves, although I do teach them how to present character and tell a story.
Okay.
Which are the keys in wrestling. Wrestling on the indie level is often simply a series of moves that lead to a finish. Successful wrestling as a career is the ability to present a character people want to see and to get them to believe in what you're showing them, regardless of the moves. The moves become less important. The moves become the pyrotechnics. Most people learn backwards. Most people learn to go for the you know, holy shit. You know, that's what they live for, is that. And that's watching fireworks. And when everybody goes home, they remember there were bright, pretty colors, but they don't remember any specific color more than another, and they don't remember any particular explosion more than another. Just remember that, gee, that was good. But if you go out there and you present somebody they want to see, and you know how to play to them, and you know how to capture the drama that is uniquely in professional wrestling, the willing suspension of disbelief, battle between, in a broad sense, good and evil, if you learn how to do that and you entertain them in the process, they'll end up remembering the stories. And that's really where the end rigim is. Most of the matches that are thought of as the best matches in the history of wrestling are story-driven matches. There may have been pyrotechnics, there may have been great technique, but what you remember are the stories, and you remember the characters. Terry Taylor always likes to say that nobody remembers much about Terry Taylor, you know, unless they're really an old-time territory fan, but he still is recognized more as the Red Rooster, which he did for an extremely limited period of time. But that's what people remember.
Right, I actually just had the privilege of interviewing Terry Taylor about 2 weeks ago. I'm a board member of the Cauliflower Alley Club and do the radio show for them. Terry Taylor is the 2014 Iron Mike honoree for the CAC. By the way, have you ever been out to the Cauliflower Alley Club reunion?
I haven't, and I should. It's been recommended to me for years. Miss Sarah and her husband Joe used to always recommend it in Nashville, and I just never went. By the way, Terry deserves that. And as the Red Rooster, as he will tell you, he was poultry in motion.
Yeah. Well, he was one of my favorite interviews because just I didn't know a whole lot about him and went back, you know, did some research, and what a multifaceted, interesting career. And he, you know, certainly after his wrestling days were over, he's contributed behind the scenes. I really enjoyed speaking with him. As you said, very worthy to receive the 2014 Iron Mike Award from the CEC. And I just talked to Morgan Dollar. I don't know if you know Morgan, executive board member of the CEC. I believe Frankie Kazarian and Christopher Daniels are scheduled to be there in Las Vegas.
Very much so. They're looking forward to that. You know, you speak about Terry, and I certainly can't compare my career in wrestling to Terry's because he was an excellent professional wrestler. But there's an aspect of our careers that are very similar. Terry is very responsible for an awful lot of people's success in helping them either hone their character or develop their character. You know, when Chris Jericho, you know, was doing ever in WCW, one of the first things that brought out a personality for him, other than, you know, the little bits he'd done in Smoky Mountain and some of the other places, that was Terry Taylor. He was that kind of guy, and right now his job in WWE is when you get to next, you're going to Terry Taylor school. You know, he's whether you like the ideas or not, the bullfighters, you know, were something he developed, and the Wyatts were something he developed, and so it's he's in the job. He does really, really well, and it's one of the reasons why he's frequently been put into talent relations positions. It was, in fact, J.J. Dillon and Terry Taylor who hired me at WCW. I've known Terry for years, and he's been a big part of my career in that I hope he saw in me something similar to what he believed was one of his gifts, and that was the ability to help other people become probably, you know, bigger stars than he was able to. And, you know, and he had his hand in the development of AJ Styles, and AJ would be the first to admit it.
You send out a newsletter. As the editor-in-chief of OWW, I get this email to me, and I try to give you a publicity bill. I try to get the newsletter out there as many times as I can. And I notice in there you have the AJ Styles, the Phenomenal One Tour. What can you tell me about that?
Came about because of a decision that Alan made not to go back to TNA, and there's a long version of that story and a short version. The short version is, without great knowledge as to the specific financial specifics, Alan was first extended for 3 months at the rate he was being paid. He had had a five-year deal and was a well-paid performer for TNA, not as highest paid, but a well-paid performer. Many considered him over the years to be Mr. TNA, and certainly with Jeff Jarrett and only James Storm were guys that were there at the beginning and you would think of as branding the company. I never quite understood why Jeff Jarrett and AJ weren't in the Hall of Fame before other folk, even if those other folk, you know, helped establish the Hall of Fame marquee, I guess, at some minor level. Certainly Sting deserves to be awarded. Certainly Kurt deserves to be awarded. But AJ was uniquely TNA. Nobody, I think, is more branded to that company. But when it came down to renewal after a five-year deal and after him having grown from one price position to another one over those 5 years in an agreement that both sides thought was fair and that they extended for 3 months at the same fair rate, they came in and said, we'd like you to do the same amount of work, but we'd like to pay you 60% of the money. And at first it was, and we really don't even want to guarantee that at all. We want to guarantee very little of it, and the word guarantee is a little loosey-goosey because we want to be able to get out of the deal within 30 days, 60 days, you know, a period of time, whereas his other deal was cancelable only year to year. His previous deal was, you know, paid out. It was guaranteed. This one, they were fighting that. And more importantly, Bruce Pritchard had left, and we had got along very well with Bruce, and Bruce had been very professional in the job, and I thought, from my side, had done a very good job there. I have no idea what they thought, but they brought in a guy that had been in production at WWE, John Gavernick, and John is very quick to tell you when you talk to him that he didn't want the job he was given because he didn't have any experience in it. He never had done contracts, he never had done talent relations, he had never done booking. So logically, of course, he was given that job. And I, perhaps part of that in experience, and I don't really know. He's a nice enough guy. I had been working with an attorney negotiating Allen's deal, Creed, who's actually an officer in Panda Energy. And he had, I had done the extension with him, and then when we started doing the negotiation, it wasn't going well for a variety of reasons. And finally, it was going so poorly that Creed suspended negotiations. And this was a month or so before the contract is up. And so there was no conversation for a period of time. There, you know, the angle was going on that AJ was, you know, had taken the belt, didn't have a contract. He did, but the angle was that he didn't, that he was an outcast, and that angle had an awful lot of truth in it, and to the point where, to this day, some people still believe that him being out on the indies is a work. But it finally, and I don't know why, but Dixie and John began reaching out to AJ by text, which they probably really shouldn't have done since we had designated myself and Creed as the negotiators. That was their decision. But regardless, they did, and Allen finally called me one night, and he said, you know, they keep telling me this can be worked out, and I said, fine, I'll call John. So 2 days before Allen's contract was up, I finally talked, for the first time, by the way, to John. Never during any negotiation I talked to him, never had he returned my calls, and it took him weeks to return my first email. He just wasn't interacting. But then we did, and things were actually getting better. But we were still stuck, inevitably, at the hardest part of it, which is we want to pay you 60% of what you've been making, but we want you to do the same amount of work. Our position was, well, if we accept the 60%, then we want to do a number of dates that's consistent with that reduction. So we'll do 60% of the dates guaranteed that reflect the money you want to spend.
Sure.
You know, that way you're within the budget you say you need, and we're not working harder for less. And that also frees up dates, potentially, for us to go out and make money on the indies, because part of the offer was that. Well, we positioned that, and everything else had been easy. Little things that were a problem, I could rewrite in the contract. John was agreeing to stuff. It looked like things were going very well, and I had told him that. I had told him things were much more positive now, and it was more likely we could move forward. But then Jeff Jarrett resigned, and that was interesting. As AJ said, if anybody was going to go down with the TNA ship, we all thought Jeff would be that guy.
Mm-hmm.
So when Jeff left, that raised an eyebrow on our end, and with Allen, it made the decision for him. We had been talking about the fact that at 36 years old, which is where he is, if he was going to go out and establish himself around the world on his own, this might be the last shot. You really don't want to try to be a top guy and go out there and work 120 to 150 shows a year when you're in your 40s. You know, go back to where I said, my first bump in my 40s, not a good idea. By the time you get to 40, your bump card has been punched pretty hard, particularly if you're AJ Styles. Mm-hmm. So with Jeff resigning, with the fact we weren't able to get an answer on less money, therefore less dates, that was, you know, a standpoint, and we're around Christmas time, and Dixie's in Mexico, so nobody's getting an answer from anybody. Allen finally said, okay, let's take a shot. Let's try it. You know, I will put my career in the hands of God, and to a lesser extent in my hands, and let's see what happens. And so we wrote them an email. That, in fact, upset them, because we wrote an email copying John, Dixie, and Creed, the people that had been involved, and I think that because John was hopeful that we had made progress, I think the email caught them off guard and for at least them, put a sour taste in their mouth, and they became a little grumpy. Regardless, Allen went out. We had already done. We had in our pocket a deal with Ring of Honor to get him started in Nashville, and we did, and they sold out the Nashville Fairgrounds, which TNA had trouble doing, if ever, back in our days of doing pay-per-views there. Since then, we've also, we had a deal right around the same time we'd cut a deal with New Japan, but that deal wasn't made clear until last month when AJ made a surprise appearance in Japan as part of the Bullet Club and attacked the current champion. He's, in fact, there this weekend facing him and has in the middle gone all over the country. He's booked anywhere from a minimum of 1 to 3 times a weekend. And that's been all over the world at this point. He's been to Canada several times, UK, Japan, He's going everywhere. Money-wise, he's on schedule to make the same kind of money he would have made with TNA, and he's charging a very high rate. But the good news is 90-something percent of the people booking him, they're drawing the best houses they've ever drawn with him, justifying that rate. And also, we're going into towns that, you know, TNA would bring a stacked card into and couldn't draw a crowd or couldn't draw the same crowd. And somehow these guys are promoting the phenomenal one AJ Styles, and they're drawing, well, like a guy just this last week in Marietta, Ohio, drew well over 1,000 people with AJ against Facade.
Wow.
And every match with AJ becomes, you know, an indie dream match. And everybody has their own version of an indie dream match. But AJ goes out on the indies as a fresh star, popular, and every match is brand new. Although, at some point, I'm pretty sure you're going to be you see AJ versus Chris Daniels, because Chris Daniels was not renewed by TNA. That was their decision. He wasn't given a choice. And there's others that aren't going to be renewed by TNA that were part of that company for quite a few years. Chris Sabin, of course, hasn't been brought back. I'm not currently helping him, but would help Josh in a heartbeat because he's a very talented young man, but I'm sure Scott D'Amore is helping him. So what we've done with Allen is we've taken his star value, and Matt Hardy likes to say, you know, he's out there building wrestling up again, you know, one card at a time, and he and AJ are sort of doing that. You know, if you can get stars out there that are willing to go out to work, to be good business, you know, show up when they're supposed to, be in shape, give the fans what they're expecting, indie wrestling as a result is seeing a bit of a growth spurt, I think. And it looks like there's going to be other avenues for wrestlers in the future, with Jeff Jarrett starting a still somewhat unknown company with his global. But there's a lot of positive things going on, and I think the nice one is that AJ has proven that you can go out there and build a business on the indies if you've got star value and a good work ethic, and you can help grow things. You know, when Matt Hardy worked AJ up in Connecticut for Mike Lombardi, they drew 1,500 people. There's a lot of good stuff. Now, the only negative we have had so far is two people couldn't figure out how to take the Styles Clash. That's the only thing we've had a problem with is first poor Roderick Strong at the very first appearance AJ had, and it was a tremendous response and a great match. And then for some reason, Roddy decided to duck his chin and turn his head as he was taking the move, which, by the way, Styles Clash is the guy giving it, AJ, takes the same bump as the guy taking it. It's a double face bump.
Mm-hmm.
You hit on your chest. You know, so why would, if you're going face down, would you, you know, turn your neck to make sure the top of your head hits the mat and jams your neck? I have no idea how that thought process starts, but it got very, very bad when he went over to the UK, and again, sold-out show against a young man who goes by the name of Lionheart. And if you watch that tape, I swear to God, it looks like the guy tried to kill himself.
Oh, wow.
I've never seen anyone try to, you know, he literally tried to bump on his back as he's going face down. And by the time he had turned his neck in, tucked his chin all the way down, he hit flat on the back of his head with AJ's body weight forcing him down.
Ugh.
And so everything else has been wonderful. That's been the only, those two minor things, and thank goodness Roddy's fine. Lionheart broke his neck and may never come back into professional wrestling as a result of it. So it also reinforces for all of us when people talk about the reality of professional wrestling, one of the great realities is everything you see actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
And and people have said, Lionheart injured in botched AJ Styles clash. Well, no, the move wasn't botched. If this were real, and remember the premise of wrestling is to try to suspend disbelief and therefore create an artificial reality. By golly, him breaking his neck is about as real as a finishing move is. I mean, you can't get more real. Like, I'm still waiting for somebody to promote a death match where it actually happens, because so far nobody's fulfilled on that stipulation yet because no one's died. A couple of Ian Rotten shows got close, but nobody's died yet.
Hmm. You mentioned the story here with AJ and his association with TNA. There was a point in time, I think, where people felt TNA may compete and provide that competition to WWE, what is the state of that company at this time, do you think? I mean, they're not drawing fans when they go out on the road. They have some talent on the roster. What do you make of TNA?
This is all speculation because I've never been privy to their books. I can only respond to having been in the company 2002 through 2005 and then 2006 through 2008. I was around it a while, and so I'm aware of a little but not aware of everything I should be. You know, I maintained spreadsheets for them. I saw what people were being paid at different times, and all I can say is there were probably mistakes made. John likes to say TNA was badly mismanaged. He said that to me. He said it to AJ, which I think is odd because, you know, well, if TNA is badly mismanaged, then they hired you. You know, so I'm not sure that that's what you really want to say because, you know, the same people that would have been badly mismanaging it are the people that would hire the next guy. So I guess the point is that mistakes were made that they hoped to fix. Well, if they were spending more than they were making, and perhaps they were, certainly in the early years, we all know that was the case. We know that financing fell apart. Panda came in, ate an awful lot of debt to get to where they are now. So it's, you know, the fact that TNA survived to this point is remarkable. It appears that whether it's John's idea on his own or a consensus idea within Panda and TNA itself, their plan, like many businesses, and you hear all the time about, we're having to streamline our workforce because of blah, blah. Most companies answer to a computer spreadsheet. And if you can make that spreadsheet, you know, look like there's a profit, then everybody's happy. And if the spreadsheet looks like there's not a profit, then stockholders get grumpy and think about suing, you know, much like going on, it appears, with WWE right now. So that whether TNA was profitable, I was told that on paper it was profitable years to year. I was also told that sometimes that was manufactured a little bit in that, well, but not manufactured in a bad way, manufactured in a way that any company would. If, let's say, you have vendors that you need to pay in November and December, well, if you can buy 90 days, even if you're telling them the check's in the mail and you make it to January, then those payments go on the next year. So you might be able to show an artificial profit in 1 year by throwing those expenses to the next year. And TNA wouldn't be the first company to do that. Mm-hmm. Right now it appears TNA's plan is to reduce the number of people they're paying the largest amount of money to, and to bring in people under the new form of contracts they're using, which in general either are pay-as-you-go contracts. Some people are paid by the spot. But the bulk of the contracts now give the talent a guaranteed amount paid out every other week at a certain amount per week. Let's make a number up and say it's $500. So they're paid $26,000 a year, and they can count on that even if they're sitting home, which is nice. Then if they wrestle, they're paid that amount again. So if they wrestle 52 times, now all of a sudden you're dealing with $1,000 a week or $52,000, and then the math continues to get better. Well, if you're an indie guy, and if you look at the people they've recently been signing, they're all indie guys or people let go by WWE development. If you go to that guy that's never made a dime really in wrestling and have been, go back to where we started, it's hard to make a living in wrestling going show to show. If you're Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards, let's use them as examples, they probably did as well as anybody could developing their own business on the indies and not having been signed by a major company. You know, they were able to get hundreds per show. How many hundreds? Who knows? But they were getting hundreds, let's go. So, but that still doesn't add up to that big a number at the end of the year, and, you know, it depends on how much they're writing off, how many other expenses they have, blah, blah, blah. Well, if all of a sudden TNA comes into that guy and says, hey, what if we give you $500 a week and $500 every time you wrestle? And, you know, at minimum, you know, if we push you, you're going to be out there at least 50 sometimes. Well, all of a sudden, that's 50-something thousand dollars. And for a guy that's been struggling to get to 25, 30, or God forbid, 40,000, that's the greatest payday they've ever had.
Right.
Use AJ Styles' example, that's speculative and pretty much sucks. Because you've earned, you know, you should be able to be paid for, you know, the time you've invested and all that stuff. So it appears what John is doing from my perspective is he's eliminating the guaranteed money. It's freeing up how many people they book and when they pay them. It's lowering the quantity of money they're paying out. And I guess the theory is as long as you've got guys that look good and wear tights, it's all wrestling. The question is that a growth position or is it a maintenance position that's simply there to save money? I believe it's the latter. I don't believe there's any growth in this. If they've rationalized, we're going to get 1 million to 1.5 million people no matter what we put in the ring, therefore, why spend the money on stars, even if that star is a homegrown star like AJ or a relatively homegrown star like Daniels or, you know, one of the founders of the company, Jeff Jarrett? If we don't want to go with that, and, you know, and we want to create new things. We got bromans, and I've helped Rob Echoes for years. Talented kid. He deserves the spot, or Spud, or, you know, EC3, all of the guys they're bringing in now. Without knowing what they're making, I'm pretty sure they're making deals that are more advantageous to TNA, but that these guys feel good about. It was harder to come to that same feeling of satisfaction with an AJ or a Chris Daniels, given the time they had invested and the expectations they had for money because they had been paid it before. Mm-hmm. So you throw out the old, you bring in the new, you put a bunch of people in wrestling tights in the ring, and you still got wrestling. The thing I'm seeing, though, and it's certainly is borne out by the rating, the audience. Last great run in numbers that TNA had was before Jeff Jarrett and Dutch Mantell lost the book and Jeff was sent home for a period of time, and that was during the Main Event Mafia run where TNA was averaging for a give or take for at least a 13-week period, and it may have been a little bit more, somewhere between a 1.3 and a 1.4 rating, which, by the way, using the thousands numbers that are published now would have probably been anywhere from about a 1.7 to 2 million people.
Wow.
Now, on average, TNA draws 1 million, and on a really great week, 1.4 million people. That would be like a holy grail week. And if you look at the run, they had been down. AJ came back for the final match with Magnus, and they popped a 1.3-something. Then for 4 or 5 weeks, because they went to the UK after that, went Huntsville in the UK after that, that short run there, up and until the debut of MVP, actually they had a run of 1.3 million pretty consistently for a period of time, 1.4 at least 1 week. Then, 5 or 6 weeks in a row, they dropped down to one. They popped back up 4 weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, they popped back up to a 1.3, pushing 1.4 million, and then they dropped back down to 1 million, and then right about 1 million, and then they bounced up to about just shy of 1.1 million last week. So what you're seeing is a greater difficulty from my side of them being able to sustain growth. What you're in now is a maintenance position, I think, for TNA. And I, as long as Spike's happy with it, and the demos are good for Spike, and the performance is good for Spike, as long as Spike is happy, it's the primary revenue generator for TNA is the contract with Spike. If Spike's happy, then this is probably a good business plan. If the goal is to grow the branches of the business tree, you know, which would be, say, the WWE plan, you know, maximize merchandise, grow into film, do, you know, all of the different pieces of a real business, then I don't think that's the current business plan that TNA is doing as well. I think they're more into, you know, saving money and being profitable on paper rather than investing any further in the potential growth of the company leading to potentially greater revenues. I think that, you know, Panda's probably said at some level, we'd prefer this no longer to be a financial drain or a tax write-off at some level. But, again, I don't know that directly. I only know that from observation and from what I've experienced when I was there and what I've seen, and also how they reacted in contract negotiations. I mean, point blank, they were expressing financial hardship.
Thank you. By the way, that was interesting information about TNA. Appreciate that. And I wanted to get your view, because you were in television for a long time, television specifically as it related to professional wrestling. What do you think about the WWE Network and how they are now sending their content out and providing it to their viewers?
It's been couched as something that's truly innovative. The reality is, we all, you know, as the internet developed and the ability to put media on the internet developed, you know, growth of YouTube, growth of various other mechanisms for putting pictures and videos and other things up, and then the flexibility of pricing for equipment. And I'll go backward. When I went to WWE, the camera I for Deep South in 2005, the camera I bought for, you know, somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500 was a mini DV camera that was at the time, you know, one of the best ones. The same one Ohio Valley was using, because, you know, we ended up getting the same equipment that they had. Spin forward to today, and you can get for $200 a high def camera, and anyone and their mother can, you know, can spend very little and get the same video quality we used to have to spend a lot of money for. Go back farther than that, and, you know, we were shooting everything, loading it on videotape, coming in, putting it together in post, having to send shows out on 3/4-inch, 1-inch, 2-inch tapes. It was a lot of expense involved in being a TV entity back in the day. Now, there's an availability. So all of us, whether it's the littlest company or the largest company, have an internet presence, and it usually involves video. You know, if you go to my NWA Wildside website, I have the old episodes being posted on a regular basis. Anarchy Wrestling, we post the TV show, and it's accessible online. Everybody in wrestling relatively has that kind of mechanism, or else they have their own little YouTube channel. So that started. TNA, WWE, both of them have had the availability of online video, as does Ring of Honor right now. The key problem, and it's been the key problem, for example, with iPay-per-view, is being able to have enough bandwidth, enough power, for want of a better word, to put a lot out there, or in the case of iPay-per-view, to even do the damn thing. You know, it's the catch-22 is you're stuck with, where am I and how good a signal am I getting and what kind of, you know, am I getting enough speed through this connection, or am I working off Wi-Fi and it's popping in and out and I'm losing my signal? And, you know, those have been the challenges of that. Well, here comes WWE, and what they did is they set up a hell of a server. They invested in the hardware that allows you to do this. They have, in essence, created what Dish does and what DirecTV does. Is they've created a mechanism to deliver product independently as long as you've got access to the internet in some fashion. Well, now everybody's got access to the internet in general as they walk around because it's everywhere.
Yeah.
So they've simply become the first not to innovate video availability, even video on demand. I mean, heck, I've had VOD, paid VOD stuff for ages that I've been doing. But the reality is, it's been in little teeny pieces. They now have created a network, the ability to broadcast an entire day, continue to feed the machine, and have it available as a library all at the same time.
Yep.
You know, cable went through a time where, you know, first they were providing the channels they were given, then all of a sudden they figured out how to do video on demand and offer movies and eventually channels on video on demand, and that grew their business. Dish comes out, Direct comes out, and they do the same basic idea. So WWE is just taking more control over how their product is distributed. Go back to what I said about TNA. You've got to grow the branches of your business tree. WWE, by eliminating the need over time to have to deal with broadcast or cable or Dish, the other mechanisms of delivery, they're now getting to the point where they can become self-sufficient to a great extent. And if they allow their product to be out in broadcast, cable, or pay-per-view, it's going to be a more limited presentation and one that is advantageous more to them. The relationship back and forth between media and the media provider is who's got the leverage. Like, if you have a hot TV show, you've got leverage, you make more money from your networks. part of the problem wrestling shows have is nothing's hot until it is, and just because it's wrestling, it doesn't mean it's going to get a number. So while you can get a show on, the success level for shows going on TV is very small. Even WWE has had that problem and have had to eliminate shows. When I was there, I consulted them to get out of the syndication business, for example, which didn't make me very popular because there's people that was their job. But it occurred to me that at the time, the primary moneymaker was pay-per-view, and only people with cable could buy pay-per-view. So what was the point of the syndicated show that they were paying a station to carry to promote that pay-per-view? Was the logic that people watching a broadcast channel would then buy cable to get a pay-per-view? There was a quantum leap in there. It wasn't going to work that way, and what they were doing is throwing good money after bad. That was a transition in business. So right now, they simply have a hell of a server. They're taking control of their own destiny, and if they can get to the point, like they assume they can, of having 1 or 2 million people paying a monthly fee, right now about $10, eventually 20, maybe 30, it'll go up until there's resistance, then it'll stay down. Just same way with your, if you have Dish or DirecTV like I do, or cable, they'll keep pushing the price up until you fight and you tell them you're going to switch to something else. And the same thing will happen with WWE, except now all the money coming in is theirs, and everything they're running, they control the expenses on. They either own it and are already paying on it, or they control how they're producing it and making it available.
So right.
They've now taken control over the delivery system at a much higher level, which is why now Dish and DirecTV and the various other people that have been in business with them are balking on certain pay-per-views. They're flexing whatever limited muscle they have as TNA takes control over its own, as WWE takes control over its own destiny.
I've enjoyed the network so far.
My theory is I have so much wrestling I own, and I watch so much wrestling, I really don't want a channel where I'd be watching wrestling. I watch very little of the. I keep up with what other people are doing, but I've found that I think for me, a wrestling channel would be overkill. I think it's a wonderful idea in terms of growing an audience base, particularly for the younger audience, which is the one most receptive to this kind of idea. The idea of having the product available in your hand is a young person thing, much more than an old person thing.
Well, also, yeah, I mean, my 9-year-old son, he can't believe that we get all the pay-per-views now, whereas before they were really expensive, and for, $9, $10 a month, whatever, now, we can watch those together. So I agree. I love it so far, but I wanted to ask you one question, Bill, before we let you go. I was down in New Orleans for WrestleMania 30. A big part of that weekend is the Hall of Fame, and you mentioned that you represent Scott Hall. What a wonderful weekend for him to be inducted into the Hall of Fame as Razor Ramon. Can you talk a little bit about Scott Hall and how special that was for him?
Just from my conversations with Scott, I know it was a true highlight, but yet also have to think about the journey Scott has decided to take finally. Scott was, for a number of years, his own worst enemy, and he'd be the first to admit it. He was, even with kids who loved him, he went out of his way for a period of time to be on a death watch list, quite literally. There's no better way of saying it, and Dallas Page reached out to him. Jake Roberts had already come there, and Jake has had his own struggles and continues to. And Scott went in. They helped him get hip replacement surgery. Cody, his son, moved up to Georgia to live with Scott. And Scott not only rebuilt his body so that he was out of pain, or at least not in the pain he was before, because sometimes when you're in pain, you come up with an excuse to self-medicate, and that leads to over-medicating. And then, he has his kid who's, 6'4", 6'5", great-looking kid, great body, has every potential of making it, and now that becomes a project. So Scott, step-by-step, and I've worked with them. They've come into my promotion. I've been helping develop Cody, too. Scott began taking relatively positive step forward all the way through, and to the best of my knowledge has had no major backslide at this point for a considerable period of time. So it's nice, as that all is happening and as he's finally taken control over his demons at some level, that WWE also decided to, you know, embrace him. You know, much like it was wonderful that they embraced Jim Helwig just before he passed, which was surprising to all of us. You know, it's nice that that happened and that Scott was able to, you know, overcome his own demons and then be recognized for his contribution and go and have a good time with it, with his friends. And that was something that, you know, I know made him feel good. And he likes going out now and interacting with people. Like, he'll never wrestle again. He's not like Jake where he's getting it, you know, where he gets surgery and then tries to go back and wrestle again. Jake continues to do that, and I think it's a mistake. You know, I think at this point, Scott's just, he's going to appear. If he gets booked with his son, Cody wrestles, and he'll manage, he'll talk, he'll sign autographs, interact with people, and have a good time. If you watch the speeches, you'll notice that while some people went long, other people got emotional, Scott tried to have a good time with it and be Razor Ramon, be the bad guy, and let, you know, because as he said to me, that's what people want to see. they want that guy. They don't need to heart-wrenching stories about, you know, his struggles with drugs. That's part of it. But they more want the bad guy. They want the guy that flicked the toothpick. They want, you know, the thing that made them interested in that guy to begin with.
I really enjoyed his speech. I was just very happy for him. And I want to thank you so much, Bill, for being here on OWW Radio. I thought this was an excellent interview. And one of my favorite points that you made, I'm really glad you talked about it, was how you're helping today's wrestlers understand this is about the story. I didn't get to make this point during the interview, but I think back, my favorite story of all time, my favorite storyline was the Mega Powers of Hulk Hogan and Macho Man and Miss Elizabeth. And at WrestleMania 5, maybe the main event match itself wasn't the greatest match ever put together, but the story around it I'll never forget, and I loved it. And I think more people like yourself that value the storytelling in this business, it's going to be wonderful, and you're helping young wrestlers move along that path.
I'll leave you with this, because that your memory is good. My memory, for example, one of my favorite angles, there's a lot of them, but I, for example, there was an angle that was done with Mr. Wrestling number 2 and Wrestling number 1, Tim Woods, who had already unmasked, and Wrestling 2, Johnny Walker, used to be called Johnny Rubberman Walker because he could dislocate his shoulder. And they did a whole thing around Tim Woods was doing a move called the three-quarter Nelson leg grapevine, and he was pinning everybody with it, and no one could get out of it. And Johnny Walker was his friend, former partner, and Johnny Walker said, "Hey, let me try." Johnny got out of the move. Tim attacked him, turned heel, and that led to a big feud in Florida, and Georgia. I remember the story, and that's the key. One of my great arguments with Vince Russo historically is Vince Russo says there's no such thing as baby faces and heels, and he's wrong. The reason he's wrong is there'll always be baby faces and heels because what we're really saying is that you have to figure out who you are and why people care, and in every match you have to give people somebody they want to win that match and somebody they want to lose that match. And it doesn't matter whether it's in a TV storyline or at an indie show on a one-off, you've got to establish who you are and why either you should be beaten or you should win. As I try to tell the guys, what is a vampire? Is a vampire a heel or a babyface? Well, if the vampire lunges at your throat, rips your throat out, and blood spurting everywhere, probably a heel. If a vampire falls in unrequited love with a lovely girl and resists his evil temptations and becomes better as a result of it, he's a babyface. Same guy, same basic character, but it's how that character is played. Put the vampire that rips your throat out against somebody trying to kill the vampire, that guy, is the guy trying to kill him, is now the babyface. Put the sexy vampire that's in love against a guy trying to hunt down vampires, now that guy, the hunter, is the heel. That's the key of wrestling. Not white hat, black hat, but who do I get emotionally invested in?
Mm-hmm.
And if wrestlers go out there and figure out who they are, if some wrestler has a superlative on their name or they've come up with a name for themselves, you know, I'm the blah, blah, blah guy, if you can't explain in a couple of sentences what that means and how it translates to your match, you haven't accomplished anything with that character. the greatest challenge for these guys is most people come up with a wacky name for their character before they ever put on a pair of tights or get their first wrestling match. They already know the name of their wacky character. I'm the ultimate whatever. But if you don't know how to explain that guy to an audience, nobody will ever care. And you won't draw money in wrestling.
Well said. Before we let you go, where can people find you and Showbiz Inc. on social media? About a website, a Twitter?
The Twitter is at William Behrens, my last name, B-E-H-R-E-N-S. The website is SBSBI, Show Business Inc., SBIBookings.com. My old Wildside stuff, if anybody's interested in looking at old stuff with AJ Styles and Jimmy Rave and Abyss is Justice and Hernandez and New Jack and all sorts of folk like that that were part of our little family, they can go to NWAWildside.com. And then right now, Anarchy-Wrestling.net is the current company that I'm helping book. Todd Sexton and I, Todd Wiley. Got to be called Bookers of the Year last year for that one in the state of Georgia. So some good stuff still happening there. And, in fact, one of our guys, Stephen Walters, was just signed to a development deal and is in Florida now.
And we should have made this point. The NWA Wildside, you are not associated with the current NWA, as some people may correlate.
No, fortunately, I have no association with the current NWA, nor would have any desire to do so. The NWA I was involved in, I was there from 98 through 2012, and then we brought in some new members. They decided to litigate, and the end game of that litigation was to take control of the brand and to eliminate the current members, the membership at that time, and they were very successful at that. Interesting time, one I would never want to repeat again. I've only been sued twice in my life, and both have had to do with professional wrestling. That was one of them, and at least it's over. And the other one was when USWA went out of business, and we were all sued. That one I showed up in court, at least, and the judge said, "Why are you here?" And I don't know. And they sent me home, thank goodness. Unfortunately, I wasn't sent home as quickly from this other one, and I've learned that I never want to visit Brownsville, Texas again in my life.
Thank you again, Bill, for being on OWW Radio. I hope there's a chance we may see you in Las Vegas this June for the CAC reunion. The Cauliflower Alley Club would love to have you there. If not, maybe a future reunion. But thank you so much for spending the time with us today, and I really, really appreciate the interview.
Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon. Don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com for latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. Email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We'll also be posting directly to the official OWW Facebook homepage. Till next time, I am David. Thanks again to Bill Behrens of Showbiz Inc. for today's excellent interview. We hope that you enjoyed it, and we'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio.